vitally important to establish patient protections on a state level.
Alaska doctors want some Affordable Care Act provisions enshrined in state law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage residents will be the first in the state to vote by mail.
So it's harder and harder each year to have enough workers to make Election Day happen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
While Congress has debated repealing the Affordable Care Act, some doctors want to make sure that at least parts of the law remain in place in Alaska. They're sponsoring two initiatives that could be on the ballot next year and have impacts on the state's healthcare system. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
One initiative would enshrine in state law the Medicaid expansion that Governor Bill Walker executed. The other initiative would include several other provisions of the Affordable Care Act in state law. Anchorage Dr. Graham Glass is one of the sponsors of the Medicaid expansion initiative. His neurology and sleep medicine practice has seen a difference from the expansion.
We see patients that otherwise we probably would have never seen, where we're able to do things such as treat their sleep apnea earlier on, before they have heart attacks and strokes and then end up being seen in the hospital as uninsured patients.
He notes that if Medicaid didn't cover those patients, the cost to provide emergency care to them would be shifted to patients with insurance. The Medicaid expansion has covered 35,000 more Alaskans. Another group nearly as large signed up for Medicaid or Denali Kid Care since the ACA went into effect. Glass says the political support for federal funding for the expansion means the state should be able to afford it.
The fact that we have a Republican president and Republican Congress, and they were still unable to pass that repeal in any way, shape, or form, makes me fairly comfortable that moving forward in the next administrations for the years into the future, it's very unlikely that that federal money will go away.
The other initiative would require insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions. It also would allow parents to cover their children until they turn 26. And it would require health plans to have 10 essential benefits, including mental health care and prescription drugs. Both initiatives are being reviewed by Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott's office to ensure they're eligible to be placed on the ballot. For instance, they can't require the state to appropriate money. Andrea Nutty with the Alaska Nurses Association says the union's members will support gathering signatures for the petitions. She says it's important that the ACA protections remain in place.
With the current instability in Washington, D.C., it's vitally important to establish patient protections on a state level.
Some Alaskans, including U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, have called for ACA mandates to be scaled back in order to make insurance more affordable. 2,200 Alaskans buy individual insurance or family insurance, costing roughly $1,000 a month because they don't receive subsidies based on income. But another 14,000 Alaskans who are subsidized pay an average of less than $100 a month. Nutty says there are other ways to reduce the cost of health care, beginning with making prices more transparent to the public.
It's still vitally important that all of those essential health benefits are included in all insurance plans because you can't predict when life is going to throw you a curveball.
Malott has until early October to review the initiatives. If he approves them, the sponsors must gather 32,000 signatures to petition to place each initiative on the ballot. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Governor Bill Walker registered today as a candidate for next year's election for governor. He'll be joined again on an unaffiliated ticket by Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. Walker says being unaffiliated has helped him and Malott work on issues without concern about party politics. It allows them to avoid a primary battle before a general election that could include candidates from both major parties.
I think it'll be a lively race. I think there'll be lots of competition. Not so much for us, certainly in the primary, but in the general. So we'll see how that plays out, and we'll just continue to do our job and make Alaska a safer place and work on the fiscal situation and work on the future of the state as far as growing Alaska.
Walker says they'll point to their record, including expanding Medicaid coverage. Lieutenant Governor Malott says he will keep his Democratic Party affiliation despite running for office unaffiliated. Malott adds Walker has worked to close the budget gap, grow the economy, and treat all Alaskans fairly.
I think Alaskans are going to look at what Governor Walker has accomplished in his first 4 years and say he did good.
The Walker and Malott campaigns must each gather roughly 3,200 signatures to be placed on the ballot. Although still a few months away, Anchorage is getting ready for its first election to be conducted by mail. In April, as residents pick a mayor and weigh in on a controversial public bathroom measure, they'll be sending envelopes to a sorting machine that arrived at the city's election center this morning. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Moving trucks pull up to an expansive warehouse that's mostly empty, except for new election equipment and a few computers. Workers take apart large wooden crates, each one a cube about shoulder height, the kind of crates you expect to hold rare artifacts or treasure. But instead, the cargo is sorting trays and a boxy machine that resembles a filing cabinet.
The Bell and Howell signature verification and envelope sorting equipment.
Amanda Mosier is the city's deputy clerk and is responsible for overseeing much of the multi-year process converting Anchorage to a vote-by-mail election system. This particular piece of equipment is a crucial part of the new order. Voters will now get ballots sent to them about 3 weeks before an election. They can turn them in at any time, either by mail or putting them inside giant metal deposit boxes distributed across town or at a drop-off site. When the envelopes arrive here at Election Center, down by Ship Creek, the machine starts comparing signatures to those on record and sorting valid ballots to tabulate the votes.
And so we'll be able to do this process for weeks before the election. And we're going to be scanning the results, but not finalizing them. So on election night, we will be able to report results as the polls close.
The Bell and Howell machine cost the municipality a little over $600,000 and includes another $57,000 contract for continued installation and support. The change to a vote-by-mail system only affects local municipal elections, like those for mayor, assembly, and school board seats, along with bonds and ballot propositions. For state and federal elections in November, there will still be 122 polling sites set up across the city. Mosier says part of the reason the city started looking into vote-by-mail in 2014 was to save on the expense of staffing so many locations and maintaining the equipment. Local officials are hoping to increase turnout in local elections, which has been between just a third and a quarter of eligible voters in recent years. The traditional voting model also depends on hundreds of trained election workers.
We're really beginning to see a lot of those folks retire, and we're not getting backfill. So it's harder and harder each year to have enough workers to make Election Day happen.
Three states have already implemented vote-by-mail systems, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. The clerk's office has been looking to them as models while it designs procedures of its own, tries to get voters ready for the big change in how Anchorage residents pick their local government. You can find more information on Vote by Mail at our website, alaskapublic.org. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Quinnahawk commercial fishermen have no buyer for their catch.
To no income in our family right now. It's really hard on us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs, from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This afternoon, more than 50 pilots and flight attendants picketed in front of Ted Stevens International Airport in Anchorage. Their goal was to call on Alaska Airlines management to give them what they view as fairer wages and benefits. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
While passengers were arriving to catch various flights at the airport, a group of pilots stood in front of the departure terminal. They silently held signs with messages like, "This merger won't fly without the pilots on board," and "Culture ain't no sunshine when it's gone." Alaska Airlines purchased Virgin America last year and became the fifth largest U.S. carrier. Virgin had been in similar contract negotiations prior to the merger. Pilots from both Virgin and Alaska, along with flight attendants, were picketing to show management that they were united in their demands for new contracts.
We've been negotiating for almost a year and a half, and management has insisted that we should be willing to work at a discount from our peers across the industry.
Captain David Campbell is a pilot and spokesman for the Airline Pilots Association, the union that Alaska Airline pilots are a part of. Campbell says the picketing was less of a protest and more of a show of unity. He says the list of demands the pilots have isn't exhaustive.
So we have limited these contract negotiations to only three items. Those are pay, retirement in the form of 401k contributions, and job security in the form of scope.
Campbell says that pilots with Alaska Airlines make about 20 to 23% less than their peers in other organizations. The company reported profits last year of more than $900 million, but also paid employees $100 million in bonuses in February. Alaska Airlines spokespeople wouldn't comment beyond what was sent out in a press release on Friday. The statement said that the company hopes, quote, "for a resolution through arbitration that will result in our pilots receiving a significant wage rate increase while maintaining Alaska Airlines' ability to successfully grow and compete." Campbell says the union has met with arbitrators in order to hash out their proposal for Alaska Airlines management. He wouldn't say what kind of pay raise the pilots are asking for.
We believe that our position is reasonable. It's certainly affordable. It's what every other carrier offers to their pilots. And so in that sense, we're hopeful that our argument will win the day.
He says arbitration proceedings will begin next week. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
An oil and gas company is suing the state for more than $5 million in unpaid cash credits. According to the lawsuit, Miller Energy Resources wants anything that happened before it went bankrupt in 2015 to be off limits to state tax auditors. And until the lawsuit is resolved, it wants the state to set aside a chunk of the cash credit payments it's owed so it won't be paid to other companies in the meantime. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has the story.
This lawsuit, it's a new snarl in the complicated knot of the state's controversial cashable oil and gas tax credits program. At its core, it's a fight over just how fresh of a start a company can get when it goes through bankruptcy. Well, Glacier Oil and Gas Chief Executive Officer Carl Giesler says it's not really a fight.
What the suit is about is not so much about oil and gas tax policy or even about the wisdom or not of cash tax credits. It's really about the picayune and, frankly, often tedious but still important aspects of bankruptcy law.
And to understand the bankruptcy law they're quibbling over, we have to back up. Giesler's job title is a relatively new one. Back in 2015, he was the CEO of a company called Miller Energy Resources. And that company and some others that it owned were working and applying for exploration and production tax credits from the state. Then they turned around and sold some of those credits back to the state for cash. Then oil prices crashed, some lending fell through, and Miller Energy slid into bankruptcy. And when it emerged, it had new owners and a new name, Glacier Oil and Gas. And this distinction between old and new companies, pre- and post-bankruptcy, it's important because the state's tax division is just now getting around to auditing tax credits that were paid to companies back in 2010, when Glacier Oil and Gas was still Miller Energy. Ken Alper is the director of the state's tax division. He can't talk specifically about companies that the state owes credits to, but he can talk generally about the auditing process. Every year, the auditors sit down and go through records of old tax returns or tax credits the state's issued.
And if we find an error or an overpayment or an invoice that shouldn't have been paid on or something like that, we'll make an adjustment to a past tax credit and say, you owe us the difference. essentially.
Those adjustments typically bring in more than $100 million a year. And if the state finds that a company owes back taxes and the state happens to owe that company money, like the $5 million it owes to Miller Energy, well, Alper says the tax division will just subtract what it's owed from the balance and then pay out the rest. But Giesler says all of that stuff that happened pre-bankruptcy, that should be out of bounds.
And what we think is that one of the key tenets of bankruptcies is meant to create a clean start for the new entity.
A fresh slate for Giesler means that the state shouldn't be able to take pre-bankruptcy debt from the millions it owes his company now.
That defeats the whole point.
And until that's resolved, the company wants the state to put aside a chunk of the $5 million it's still owed. That way, if the judge rules in their favor, there will still be money left to pay it. And that's a real concern, because the state isn't paying off the cashable credits it owes to the companies immediately. It's making minimum payments. And in Miller Energy's case, the state's actually refusing to pay any of the $5 million it owes to the company until the case is resolved.
But what we don't want to do is risk having a Pyrrhic victory where the judge rules in our favor, and then we turn to the Department of Revenue and they say, sorry, we've already paid out all the money that was appropriated by the state legislature and governor. There's none left for you.
Ken Alper can't say how much tax credit money is going where, but he did say that when the money is disputed, the tax division holds on to it.
Their share is being set aside. So we're not going to give it to anybody else.
The company and the state will meet in court in Anchorage on August 22nd. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
A Naknek man was killed after he went overboard returning from a hunting trip with three others late last night. 35-year-old Brian Anderson was the well-known varsity boys coach at Bristol Bay High School. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
State troopers say Anderson was on a skiff with Jack Savo of Dillingham and two others, crossing Aleknagik late after a hunting trip. There were life jackets on the boat, but Anderson was not wearing one when he went overboard. Sergeant Luis Nieves of the Dillingham office.
One of the passengers actually witnessed him falling off of the boat. That passenger immediately shouted to the operator, who was Mr. Savo. He maneuvered the boat to recover Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson was unresponsive.
Nieves says the party pulled Anderson to shore and attempted to resuscitate him with no success. The party then traveled quickly back to the boat launch at Aleknagik.
They were met by local EMS that then transported Mr. Anderson to Kanakanak, where they continued life-saving measures until he was pronounced deceased at approximately 0250 hours.
The state's medical examiner's office did request an autopsy. Nieves said alcohol may have been involved, but he was not sure of any other contributing factors to the tragic accident, such as weather or speed or the vessel having struck an object. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Several weeks ago, the financing fell through on a plan to bring the floating fish processing vessel Accutan to Kuskokwim Bay, and for the second summer in a row, fishermen in the coastal community of Quinnahock had nowhere to sell their catch. Many in the village are now struggling to make ends meet. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports.
Timothy Johnny Boy Matthews doesn't remember when he started fishing commercially. He must have been five or maybe six. On most summer evenings, Matthew's father would load him and his brother into a wooden boat he built himself and sail into the Kuskokwim Bay. They would net salmon for the next 12 hours, working through the short, sunny night. Matthew's job on board was to count the reds, kings, and chums his father caught, though eventually, as the night wore on, he would fall asleep in the boat's cabin. When his father sold the fish, he made sure to share the profits with his sons.
Every time he pays me, he would tell my mom,
Here's the money he got for sleeping.
Matthews has a family of his own now. He bought his own limited entry permit a decade ago and spent his summers selling silvers to a newly opened processing plant in Platinum, owned by the Coastal Villages Region Fund, a corporation that is supposed to use its Bering Sea fishing quota to support economic development in the area. Matthews remembered when fishermen could make about $6,000 a year selling to Platinum. And some in Quinnahawk say that in good years, expert fishermen could earn more than $20,000 a season. But Coastal Villages decided not to open its plant last year, saying it was losing money. There was nowhere to sell fish and limited prospects for any sort of summer work.
Due to no income in our family right now, it's really hard on us.
Matthews works as the maintenance man at the local Head Start during the school year. But in the summers, he says he doesn't have any money coming in. His phone's already been cut off.
Our water and sewer is going to be cut pretty soon.
After 2 years without a buyer, a lot of the fishermen in Quinnahawk tell similar stories. Jimmy Annever is an elder here. He worked as a commercial fisherman for over 60 years, first in Bristol Bay, then in the Kuskokwim Bay, right up until the Platinum plant closed.
High prices in the stores fill up all those credit cards all the way up to $10,000 or more like that. It's hard to live here in Alaska.
Last year, a fish broker tried to buy in Quinnahawk, but Coastal Villages refused to lease him equipment. And now, a second plan has fallen through.
We had really high hopes. All the fishermen were getting excited. We were getting excited. And then we got the news that he's not coming. Everybody just, oh no, not again.
Warren Jones is the CEO of the local Native Village Corporation. Before the Platinum plant opened, he was the operations manager of a processing facility right here in Quinnahawk.
Okay, so this is the old fish plant?
Yes. Everything was running good.
Not anymore. The plant is sunken and rusted. Jones says that he tried to get Coastal Villages to give or sell Quinnahawk some of the plant's unused buildings. There's a housing shortage here.
But as you can see, they're sitting right there, rotting away.
As a leader in the local Native Corporation, Jones says he's doing what he can by hiring locals part-time.
Like I offer, you can work 2 weeks and 2 weeks off, so the other person get a little paycheck too. People are suffering, and winter's coming. And the corporation here is doing as much as we can. I mean, we're extending their credits. People are running out of fuel. We can't let nobody freeze to death, so we let them charge more.
Jones says that at this point, he keeps several gallons of heating fuel on hand at his home. He never knows when someone might knock on his door at 2 a.m. in the winter, asking for heat. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Millions of Americans traveled to watch the eclipse for a few minutes, but a few people took to the skies to watch it for hours. Sitkin's Cindy Edwards and Brantman were on a regularly scheduled flight from Portland to Minneapolis today. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
Their flight left Portland an hour before totality, just as the eclipse started, and it only got better.
We actually sat in the front seat on the right side of the plane. So we were looking south as we flew east, and we were looking right at the eclipse. And it was so cute because the flight attendant in the front and the back, we kept giving them our glasses because we were like giving them the play-by-play. So they kept putting the glasses on and we'd get up and move. And then little by little, like all the different people in the plane that would look up looking interested, were like, come on, come on. So the plane was just constantly like streaming up to that front seat and putting on our glasses and looking out because we had such a long viewing of the eclipse. I couldn't believe it. It was consistent across the 3.5 hours of our flight. We had the eclipse the whole way.
Edward says that even the pilots came back and checked out the eclipse from their front row seats. That everyone got such an excellent look at the event was much more than a coincidence. Edward says her husband, Brant Brantman, has had plans in the works for, well, a long time.
You know, the trouble started when Brant was a young child and he had an album that was all about the galaxy. and all of the songs in the album were about the sun and the moon and the stars, and it set a trend in his life. He has been following that trend all his life. He is so enamored by space. And so he did the work. He figured out we're going to go 520 miles per hour east, and he knew what time it was all going to happen. He was watching videos, and he was a nerd.
Although their flight path did not cross the totality, Edwards and Brantman were pretty close, more than 90%. Edwards says there was just a sliver of sunshine, and it never got completely dark. Yet she witnessed something that earthbound viewers can only imagine.
With just a thin hair, it was light out. But as you looked across the landscape, you could watch it getting darker and darker. And so you could see, like, way off on the southern side of the plane, you could see it dark in the distance. It wasn't like there was a fine line of and then pure darkness, but it was definitely dark out there. Like, okay, they're probably in totality.
The sky, she adds, was a palette of blues, like an impressionist painting. And the question all of us far from the eclipse have for those who went to extraordinary effort to see it, what does it all mean? Did you have a personal spiritual catharsis of any kind watching this?
I think it's one of those moments where you realize how little you are. You know, when you were a little kid laying in the field looking up at the stars, and you just felt so teeny weeny? It definitely felt like that.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees.
Warning to parents, this is the actual song that hooked Brant Brantman on space. Keep an eye on your credit card accounts and be alert for any air travel booked between Dallas and Buffalo in 2024. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
We need its light. We need its heat. We need its energy.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.